All right, buddy, come on in, find a seat. We're going to go ahead and get started. Hey, rabble rouser. Oh, you two. I should separate you two. Good evening. Welcome to the class. This is the first of probably many. The last couple of times I've done this class, it takes about a year to get through all the material. There's several hundred slides, about 100 pages of notes, and I'm adding to it. So this class will take a while, but we're going to cover a lot of things in some detail. I'm more than happy to answer your questions along the way, obviously, so raise your hand if you've got a question. If you want to talk to me afterwards, that's fine as well. A couple of things just so you know. My job requires me to travel quite a bit, usually on weekends, so a Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So there will be weeks that I won't be here. I will do my best to tell you the week out, of course. I can tell you now I won't be here the Thursday before in February, like the 11th, I think it is, of February. I won't be here. Otherwise, I'll be here up until then. A couple of other things here, too. I have notes that I've added to over the years, but I'm updating them as I go, so I'm not giving out those until they're done. So just kind of keep that in mind. I'm more than happy to give them to you, and I'll even give them to you in their partial, semi-completed form if you'd like them. But I am adding some sections to it and just updating as we go. The last time I did this, I think it was 2012 that I actually taught the class. A few of you have probably seen these before. I call these my cheat sheets. References and basics. I have three copies of them. They were back there. Whoever found them, good job. These are being updated as well. So next week I'll have all the new information on it. I just didn't have time to get them all on there before today. I'm adding another section to this that we're actually going to talk a little bit about tonight. It's on information theory, and I'm a total geek and nerd. I love that stuff, and so I'm trying to wade through all the information to make sure that I'm not going to bore you today. So I am adding some information to that. So next week I will have copies of these. I have three of these right now. If you want them, you can more than welcome to grab them if you haven't seen them before. There's three pages front and back. They're basically cliff notes, if you will, for a lot of the subjects that we'll cover. Something else that we're going to be doing here in the next, just to be aware of in the next few weeks, and is that we will start. Well, I'm going to do my best to start at 7 o'clock. I'll be done and out of here by 8 o'clock at the latest. Okay. Some classes will run 45 minutes. Just kind of depends on what the subject matter is, because I don't want to have an uncomfortable break in the material. I don't plan on going any longer than an hour at any given time, tops, because that's a lot to digest. It's a lot for me to talk through and explain, and the last thing I want you to do is miss it. We will be watching a few videos throughout the course of this class. They're hopefully going to match pretty well with the specific subject material we're going to cover. I say hopefully because some of them are combo movies where they cover a lot of different subjects. Also, I just brought a few of the books that I've read, and this is actually a copy that I didn't use. I had two copies of this one. The other one fell apart. I have a few copies of the books that I've used to put this class together. There are numerous other sources that I did not bring because they're on the internet, so you can get them wherever you want. But there's a lot of information out there. And a lot of these different sources, you're more than welcome to look at these. If you want to know which books they are, your best bet is take a picture of the ISBN on the back. You can easily look them up and find them pretty much where they are. Most of the books, I think the most expensive one is right around $30, and that's this one. It's In the Beginning. Fantastic book. It's a textbook. I mean, it's for every chapter, there's about the same number of pages of in-depth, hardcore, mind-boggling, and sometimes mind-numbing information on how he came to the conclusions that he does. So any of these books, highly recommend them. Interesting thing that about some of these, Darwin's Black Box is one that I use a lot of, specifically when we're dealing with molecular biology and when we're talking about genetics and when we're talking about creation and how something as complex as the gene could come about, or specifically the bacterial flagellum. Interesting thing about this book, actually interesting thing about the author, is that he's not a Christian. Not at all. Not even close. Doesn't even claim to be a godly person. But he's a smart man, and he's relatively honest. However, if you read the last section of this, he believes we came from aliens. So I'll tell you that right now. Okay? So the thing is, this information and anything that we're going to be studying in the class, there's a lot of information out there, and it's not going to always come from what we'll call godly sources. But there are a lot of scientists out there who realize that there are some significant problems with the theory of evolution. And so because of that, you're going to run into some strange things like that. You know what? I hope Michael Behe figures it out. I really do. But whether or not he does, it's not my choice, that's for sure. A couple of other things, too. If you get the chance, if you have one book and you want some real straightforward, real easy to understand information that's not going to take you years to digest and understand and teach, this is a good one. It's called Gaining the High Ground Over Evolution. It's by Robert J. O'Keefe. These are usually available at family camp when, at least that's where I got mine. Pretty good information, and they're not overwhelming. So there's a lot of good information out there again. As far as the movies are concerned, I have a whole bunch of them. I have lists of them. We will watch a number of them, as I mentioned. Others I'll just mention in passing, and we won't watch them. But if you have any questions on that, where you can get them, so on and so forth, please let me know. A couple of primary sources for the web. I didn't think about it until after I got home, so I didn't update my slide. But a couple of primary web sources that I use, if you're really interested in digging into some of this stuff, creation.com, a fantastic source of really, really solid Christian evidence information. Apologeticspress.com. That one's really good because it covers everything from the creation evolution debate all the way through to whether or not we can trust the Bible. It's called apologeticspress.com. I will provide these lists. I think they're on some of the other ones, but if you want to look them up in the meantime, you sure can. ICR, the Institute for Creation Research, is another fantastic source of information. And as with anything, there's going to be some disagreements in some of these fields, in some of these areas. Oh, and one other one. This book, by the way, if $30 is a bit much for you to spend, totally understand it. This book, this entire book, is available on his website, creationscience.com. So you can see every page in this book, all the illustrations, all the scientific material, all the pictures that he references, everything is on his website, creationscience.com, and it's free. You can actually buy a digital copy of it if you'd like. I mean, the digital copies are between $15 and $20. It's a PDF. This is, as far as In the Beginning is concerned, this is his eighth book. It's his eighth edition. I don't believe that Walt's producing another one. Last time I talked to him, it was 2012-ish that I talked to him last, and he wasn't doing well physically. So I believe he's in his 80s now. So smart guy, he's a PhD. But anyway, this is a great book for overall discussion. That one focuses primarily on the flood and what he calls the hydroplate theory. And what you'll notice as we move on through some of this material is that more and more of the creation scientists are picking up his theory and understanding that he has the best set, he has the best theory to answer all the questions that are out there. And so a lot of good information there as well. So creation science, most scientists today, they dismiss the study of creation from the perspective of the existence of a creator who made this universe, who made this creation. They dismiss it as nonsensical. Well, I can't speak this evening. As only the pursuit of those that are ignorant, and really something that's best left in the realm of myth. So it's a good question to ask. But is creation science a myth? Is it even possible to study the concept of creation from a scientific perspective? They're good questions to ask. Yes. Oh, on one of the amps down below, you'll see in wall left and right. Just turn them all the way down. Yep. So is creation science? Is it even possible to say that? And if you, for those of you that have been around for the other classes that I've done, and even on the top of those, I used to call it scientific creationism. I didn't like the name. I came up with it initially, and it sounds too much like a, you know, we're trying to pigeonhole it into some sort of dogma. And that's really not what we're trying, but not what I'm trying to accomplish. So I've changed the name of this to be creation science. So this class is intended to present information for the purpose of equipping Christians to make a logical, reasoned, scientific defense of the biblical view of creation. The thing is, one of the worst things we could ever do is say, you know what? All this creation stuff, it's nonsense. You know, anybody that believes evolution is stupid, and there's no reason to talk about it. Oh, well, that's a good job. That works great. That's really appealing to people. It's the last thing you want to do. The thing is, most of us in this room who have... Let me see your raise your hands if you don't mind. How many of you have gone to public education? Okay, overwhelmingly most of you. I was raised in a non-Christian household as well. And so I went to years of, you know, public education. And evolution was just assumed to be true. It was never taught as a theory. It was never taught as something that is yet to be proven. It was always taught as that's the reason for the things that we see in the universe. Well, the problem with that, of course, is that as we move on in this class, actually, it's funny enough, the first section we'll cover in detail is on information theory. We could cover that one class, and if you understand information theory, we don't need the rest of it. Seriously. However, information theory is a little abstract. So there's a lot of other things that people are going to have questions about. And really, again, the whole point of this class is to help you have the information, have the confidence of being able to say, you know what, when somebody asks me a tough question, when they wonder about, well, what about this whole man and dinosaur thing? Or, well, wait a minute, how can that be so? Because I know, they know, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. Well, how do you arrive at that number? Where did it come from? What are the assumptions that are made in order to arrive at that number? One of the things that I want you to walk away from with this class is helping you understand that the information that you're going to be presented is an introduction. If you find any of these particular subjects really super interesting and you want to dive into it until your eyes turn inside out and you're up your eyeballs in information, great, let me know. I'll tell you where to go. Or you can find it yourself. But this is just meant to be an introduction. It's also, of course, to strengthen our own faith. The thing is, since I've studied this in the last 10 years or 15 years or so, I tell you what, I can't help but be at awe of God's creation when I'm out in it. When I drive between here and in Bozeman, Montana, if you've ever made that drive, you'll see all over the place, you'll see all this broken strata or all these angles of different layers of the earth. And I used to look at that and go, huh, that's pretty cool. Now I look at it and go, right there, that's God's signature written all over it. So why do we have this class? Well, it's obviously to strengthen our faith, and it's to present a logical, scientific defense of biblical creation. Because guess what? It is possible. God's given us all the information that we need. An important aspect of this class and any such discussion on biblical creation is the necessity to have pure motives in our approach with people. The last thing I want you to walk away with from this class is to be armed with this information and go club somebody with it. It's not effective. So, obviously, I hope your motives are, of course, pure in understanding this. I want you to come in with this with a logical and open mind, of course. The topics that we are going to discuss are designed to enlighten you so that you'll be able to save the lost and not just beat them over the head, as I mentioned. We need to act out of love for those that are lost and for those that are asking questions. And it's also important to understand that none of the things I'm going to be covering are salvation issues. Okay? If you have a firm belief that man and dinosaurs did not live together, you know what? You can take that up with God. But ultimately, it's not a salvation issue. I think it will affect your faith, but it's not a salvation issue. So I don't want you to walk away from this saying that this is absolute gospel, because it's not. It's science. Okay? God also, in His infinite wisdom, doesn't give us all the ins and outs of creation. So one of the things you're going to learn from this, and I'm probably going to say it a lot of times, is that we can't go back and replicate this. None of us were there on the day of creation. None of us were there when God put this whole universe into existence. None of us were there. Nor can we go back and see it again, and we can't recreate it. We'll actually see that when we start discussing some of the basic theories that deal with cosmology, that the universe cannot explain its own existence. We can't do it again. It's not like we can do this in a test tube. You know, despite what all the popular movies will tell you, you can't do that. Okay, so we don't have the ability to go back and prove this 100%. Okay. What God has done, though, is He has put everything together. He's put it into motion. He doesn't tell us how He created it, and He doesn't tell us how He maintains it either. I mean, He has a little bit of an inclining that He tells us, and He says that it is by the word of His power that all things are held together, but that doesn't tell us much. Okay? He doesn't tell us how it's all held together, but what He does do is it leaves us a trail of breadcrumbs. In all of creation, every aspect we're going to look at, there are things that are going to lead back to the existence of an immortal and eternal and superior creator in every aspect we're going to look at. John, would you read Psalm 19:1 for me, please? I want to read a couple of scriptures here just to give you some biblical basis for why we're covering some of this material. And John has so graciously volunteered to read for me.
Psalm 19:1, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands.
So everything we're going to look at, it's ultimately going to talk about the glory of God. And that's the great thing about the creation. Doesn't matter how far you look, doesn't matter how big the subject is or how small it is, everywhere in between there's evidence of God. And then another passage here for the purpose of understanding why it's applicable in our day and age comes from Romans chapter 1. And he's going to start in verse 18. And you want to read all those for me? Okay. I roped him into it earlier. He wants to really bad. Starting in verse 18 through 23.
For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and the unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power, and His divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures.
So, in verse 20 there, I think it's rather interesting, especially as we look at information theory. Verse 20 talks about how God has made it evident to the world, to the things that have been made, that He exists. When we look at, as I mentioned, information theory, it is amazing how accurate that statement is. So, we're going to be working through this for the purpose, of course, of helping you have the information to help answer the people's questions. You know, the world is skeptical, and I'm great. I'd actually rather deal with somebody who's a skeptic and who has great questions. I mean, any of us who've ever led a Bible study or a study on anything like this, you know how frustrating it is when you can just go through it and they go, uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. And there's no questions. There's no challenges. There's no thinking through the material. It's just, yeah, I'm here to warm a seat. Okay? So the world is skeptical, and that's great. And of course, we want to be able to answer people's questions because their questions are based in reality. It's not like they're coming up with these because they just want to be difficult. It's because they have honest questions. So, of course, we were going to demonstrate some areas where science and the Bible agree. Not every piece that we talk about is going to have a direct scriptural reference. Because you know what? The Bible isn't a science book. It isn't. And through the years, between the Bible and science, science has been wrong more times than the Bible ever has. So ultimately, where are we going to put our faith? I'm going to put it in the scriptures, of course. But this class will serve primarily as an introduction to a few of the scientific approaches used to explain the physical creation and its origins. And this is, as I mentioned, it is not intended to be comprehensive. It's really supposed to be an introduction. So there are six major sections that we are going to cover in some degree. We're going to talk about information theory. Information theory is based around the premise that information and its functioning systems cannot arise from matter and energy. I'd like to say a whole lot more, but I won't. We'll talk about that as we get there. We're also going to talk about cosmology. It's the study of the origin and the general structure of the universe. Within that, we're going to look specifically at something called teleonomy. And it's a fancy word for basically saying that there's evidence of design. Okay? We're also going to talk about the origins of life. And guess what? We're not here by accident. Okay? The origins of life is going to be a fairly long section. We're going to deal with a lot of different pieces. We're going to get down to talking about adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, and sugar phosphate bonds on the backbone of the DNA structure, and how these things come about. And I'm going to overwhelm you with numbers. Because guess what? That information is so powerful in helping you understand just how impossible it is that we arrived here by accident. Okay? So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about dinosaurs and man. Yep, they did coexist. And there's so much evidence for it, it's not even funny. How many of you have heard, outside of like a church type thing, that dinosaurs and man existed together? Outside of church type things? So how many of you outside of like church related things have ever heard that dinosaurs and man existed? I never heard it. Never in a million years. No way. And when you talk about dinosaurs, you know, what was the movie? Jurassic Park, just another, like the 16th installment of Jurassic Park without or whatever. You know, it's like Rocky 5000. But the thing is, dinosaurs are cool. And they're really neat. And just as an example, we're not going to get too much into it tonight, but what, according to evolutionary biologists, what's the dinosaur's closest living relative today? The bird. It's bunk. It is. And we'll deal with that. We'll talk about it. It's a flying dinosaur. No. We'll talk about it, of course, and I'm going to make some statements that we're going to come back to, of course. I'm not going to just leave you hanging on these. But dinosaurs and man coexisted to the point where there is such evidence that the honest person looking at the evidence is going to have to ask themselves, how is this even possible? Okay? So dinosaurs and man did coexist. And, of course, we're going to talk about the fossil record. Now, the fossil record, interestingly enough, the fossil record was always identified by Darwin in his books, in both of the primary books that people use for reference to evolution. He basically said that the fossil record would prove over time that there were intermediary species between all these different primary species we see. Well, guess what? We have been digging up the fossil record for a couple hundred years, and we have not found any evidence of it yet. As a matter of fact, we find just the opposite. We don't find those transitionary species. We just don't find them. Never have in anywhere that we've looked. And so we're going to talk a lot about that. And then, of course, we're going to talk about the hydroplate theory. The hydroplate theory, as I mentioned earlier, it deals specifically with the flood described in the Bible, Noah's flood, but it goes into an amazing amount of detail to help show how a cataclysmic event that literally changed the face of the world, how the evidence of that is found everywhere. Whether you're in Siberia and you're finding frozen mammoths, which, by the way, mammoths were not cold-blooded, or they didn't live in cold climates. They lived in tropical climates. So why is it that we find so many of them buried in ice? Drastic climate change. Well, how did that happen? What was the cause of that? How about bent and folded mountains? I've never been to the Canadian Rockies since I was old enough to remember. I was there when I was a kid. But in the Canadian Rockies, it looks like an accordion. All the strata of the mountain are nicely folded, and it literally looks like an accordion. Nice zigzag pattern in the mountains. And they're not like down low there, but the tops of the mountains. Current geologic processes have no way of explaining how that works. There isn't an explanation for it. However, the hydroplate theory does provide answers to that. We'll talk more about those things as we get there. So, the material presented throughout this class is widely available. It's not of my own creation or discovery. I'm not a PhD. I have a degree in information systems and business. Okay, so I'm not a scientist. I'm just an average guy who likes this stuff and who has done a fair amount of research into it. And a lot of the information it's come from several sources, all of which will be available in the final printed bibliography, besides the books that I've listed here. To really talk about a beneficial and legitimate discussion of this subject, of the scientific evidence really on any subject, we've really got to have an understanding first of the scientific method. So the scientific method is the process by which scientists collectively and over time endeavor to construct an accurate, that is, reliable, consistent, and non-arbitrary representation of the world. In English, it's a method of investigation involving observation and theory to test scientific hypotheses. Okay? The scientific method is something that has been the very foundation of science really since it began. It actually, in some other ways, it has its foundations in the scripture. Keep in mind that the guys who developed the scientific method were God-fearing men and women who looked at the universe around them based upon the assumption that God created it. Okay? We're going to talk a little bit more about what those natural laws are and a little bit later, but the scientific method has four basic steps. And there are some subsets in these, of course, but the four basic steps, the first one, of course, is observation and description of a phenomenon or a group of phenomena. So you see something happen. Okay? Step one. Step two is the formulation of a hypothesis to explain what you just saw, what you just observed. Third, of course, is the experimentation to demonstrate the truth or falseness of the hypothesis. Okay? And then last is formulation of a conclusion that validates or modifies the hypothesis. Now, if the experiments bear out the hypothesis, it may come to be regarded as a theory or a law of nature. So you have a hypothesis, a hypothesis becomes a theory, and if it's proven and tested and replicated, it then can become a law, but there are certain criteria that it has to meet. If experiments do not bear out the hypothesis, it must be rejected or modified. Okay? So you continually do this test, and it's a circular pattern. Until you get through all the information, until you get through all the experimentation to either change the hypothesis or continue to tweak it to make it better. So one of the this is something that's inevitably going to happen. This process of repeating will inevitably bring the researcher and the observer back to step one eventually. Now, what is key in the description of the scientific method just given is the predictive power of the hypothesis or theory as tested by experiment. It's often said that in science, theories can never be proven, only disproved. So, there's always a possibility that a new observation or a new experiment will conflict with a long-standing theory. So, one of the great things about the scientific method is that it's not like you need a degree to be able to figure out the basics of it. Okay? It's something that has been, as I mentioned, used for a long time in science, but as recently, really in the last 20 to 30 years, there's been a shift away from the scientific method, believe it or not. And it's not in every realm of science, but in a lot of the major ones, specifically things like astrophysics, theoretical physics. They throw this out the window. Anybody ever heard of Michio Kaku? He's a Asian. I'm not sure what country he's from, But he's an Asian man, and he has a great series, a lot of really interesting series on physics, and I think he had a radio show called Science Fantastic for a while. Interesting guy, real smart guy, but I remember listening to a few of his podcasts, and at one point somebody asked him about the scientific method, and he said, yeah, real scientists don't really use that anymore. Okay. That doesn't really give you much of a basis to prove or disprove your theory, and then it's just your opinion. And then it's like everybody else out there that has a blog. I'm going to type this, and so what I'm saying is truth. What? The thing is that the scientific method provides a way for us to be able to test our theories. I bring up the scientific method, of course, because it is the most basic method of scientific discovery. And as I mentioned, it's not always applied. So when your current understandings are challenged through the course of this study, take some time to do some investigation and experimentation of your own. Don't take what I'm saying just as gospel, as I mentioned, but check it out, okay?
We're going to build on this?
Oh, yes, we don't.
Okay. I was going to say bias is in there somewhere.
Oh. He's ahead of me. Yep, no, that's fine. And another important nuance in understanding research is the observer expectancy effect. I'll pay you later. The observer expectancy effect, basically what it is, it's also called the observer bias effect or the observer expectancy bias effect. But anyway, this phenomenon can be defined in this way. The observer expectancy effect in science is a cognitive bias that occurs when a researcher expects a given result and therefore unconsciously manipulates an experiment or misinterprets data in order to find the expected result. Okay? So basically, in any given situation or observation or observance of some phenomena, some event, the person who is observing said phenomena will have preconceived notions or expectations about the outcome and will therefore notice things that support their subconscious preconceived notion and tend not to notice the things that could refute the desired result. This is shown, it is proven time and time and time and time again. This is why they have double and triple and quadruple blind studies on prescription drug medications, on why they have, for instance, you've seen this before, you've heard about it before, but we're in a university where they had a room full of students, and it was on a sociology class, I don't remember the exact subject, but they had somebody run in into the building, into the back room with a fake gun, and this was years and years ago before all the mass shootings, and fire off this weapon, and a couple people, you know, pretended to be dead and blah, 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 and then the person ran out. Well, of course, it was an exercise, sociology class, right? And so when they start to talk to these students, they started asking them physical traits about the person that came in with the gun. Some said he was tall. Some said he was short. Some said he was fat. Some said he was narrow. Some said he was black. Some said he was white. It was all over the board. Why? Preconceived ideas. Okay? A very wise man basically, well, the observer expectancy effect is important to understand when studying the subject of origins of creation, especially when the subjects of evolution and the origin of life are discussed. Because guess what? You're going to look at the information and you're going to look for the things that support your particular perspective. You just do it. That's the way we are. It is the way God made us. We look at the world through our own eyes. And as try as we might, we try to look at it through other people's eyes, but we can't not see it through our own preconceived notions. So, there's a video out there. It's called Icons of Evolution. And it's a great video. Discusses a lot of different subjects. But that particular video talks about the data that refutes evolution and the fact that it's being simply ignored or dismissed by the scientific community as religiously influenced ignorance. Ben Stein, anybody ever heard of Ben Stein? You know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Bueller. He was the Visine guy for a while. Super, you know, he plays kind of an interesting guy. But you know what? He is a sharp guy. A movie that I would highly recommend It's probably not a kid's movie, just FYI. It's called Expelled. And he talks about how people in the scientific community that hold a, let's just put it very simply, a design-oriented perspective on anything are blacklisted in the scientific community. One of the guys that's in the movie and several others, he actually helps write one of the books that I used. I didn't bring it tonight. His last name's Guillermo, or no, his first name's Guillermo, and his last name's Gonzalez. Really smart man. He's an astrophysicist. Him and a few other guys put together a book, made a movie. It's called Privileged Planet. Fantastic piece. Basically, since he wrote that book and made that video, he has had virtually no access to any scientific community outside of the creation scientific community. Before that, I mean, he was a tenure at the Smithsonian. So, not a stupid guy by any means. So, at any rate, this observer bias is everywhere. Yet, as you'll see throughout our discussion, the evidence, when we view it objectively, with an open mind, it exposes the junk science and the preconceived notions of evolution and many other long-held beliefs. And there's actually a guy that we might all know, Charles Darwin once put it, the observer is always biased. He had it figured out, right? I mean, he was a wise man, he was. He observed a lot of different things and he tried to come up with a solution for it. And we can go round and round and round, but at any rate, he understood that the observer was always biased. And he wrote that into his books. And it's interesting, I know it's not possible, of course, but it would be interesting to talk to him today and to show him what the Huxley brothers financed to make evolution what it is today and see what he would think about it. And he'd want to see all the information, I would hope. He'd want to see all the evidence to prove all these theories. But guess what? They're not there. It would make me curious to see what he would have to say about that. So one of the things we're going to talk about tonight, we're going to get just a little bit into it. I'm not going to get too far over your head. We'll wrap it up here in about 5 minutes. We're going to talk a little bit about information theory. As I mentioned, information theory, when it's properly understood, is one of the most powerful weapons you have against the theory of atheistic evolution, and it will also help you refute atheism itself, and it will prove to be the very foundation upon which everything is built. Everything. You would not be here if it were not for information. And it is mind-boggling to consider. So, a philosopher recently put it that the entire universe is information. He's a German philosopher, interesting guy. He's a triple PhD, so he's certainly not adult by any means. But he said the universe is essentially everything, and the universe is information. Isn't it amazing that it doesn't matter how far away from the Earth we go, or from anywhere in space we go, that 2 plus 2 is still equal to 4? I mean, I realize that that's a simple thing, but the very laws of science don't change respective to where you are in the universe. Information theory helps to prove that point. So, a definition of information theory is the mathematical study of the coding of information in the form of sequences of symbols, impulses, etc., and how rapidly such information can be transmitted, for example, through computer circuits or telecommunications channels, etc., etc. And this is from the Google Dictionary. So if you Google it, that's the answer that you get. So, well, what does this really mean? Let's talk real quickly about an example of information theory. What language am I speaking to you? American English, yeah. That's not British English. And it's not Canadian English because we don't have all the extra A's. Are any of my Canadian friends here? No, darn. Okay. Well, how do we know that? How do you know to speak English? Well, we have an alphabet, right? Okay, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Where'd the alphabet come from? Close, it's Romans. The Romans are the ones we use today. Okay, where'd they get it? They stole it from the Phoenicians. Where'd the Phoenicians get it? Well, let's back up even further. Let's ask another question. How is it possible that we have any form of communication that wasn't brought together by a bunch of people, really wise guys that, wait a minute, they couldn't... How are they supposed to figure this out? Think about information. Think about our language in and of itself. Let's say you take a bag of Scrabble letters. Okay? Those Scrabble letters, they represent symbols, right? Now, if you just take that bag of Scrabble letters, I do this all the time when I teach in a one-on-one setting about creation evolution. I'll take three letters, a Y, an E, and an S, and I'll throw them on the ground. And what do you think the probability of those landing all face up, right direction up, spelling the word yes? I have never had it happen. Never. Never once. I've done it, I don't know how many times. And I'll keep doing it, too, until you get bored of it. Okay, let's step back from that a little second. Wait a minute. You have to come up with your own letters now. And then you have to come up with a way of organizing those letters into a way that you can actually form words that make sense. Oh, but wait a minute. Where did the words come from? Where did the ability to understand it come from? The thing is that information is a non-material entity. It is neither matter nor energy. Do you ever think about that? Information is not matter or energy. It is a non-material entity. Therefore, it is not subject to the laws of nature. Which means we cannot look at nature to explain where a non-material entity came from. Okay? Let me give you another example. Let's say you take a rock, and you put a rock in a very, very powerful solution of sulfuric acid. It'll bubble, and it'll churn. It might even foam. And out, as it overflows the beaker, out comes a whole new language. It doesn't work that way. The very system upon which we use, or upon which we build our ability to be able to examine the world around us, did not come from what we are examining. It's kind of mind-boggling if you think about it. So let me give you an illustration about how information is not matter. Okay? Let's say we're out on the beach. Say we're out in Florida on the beach, or beautiful Texas. We're out in what's the big resort down in Texas? Corpus Christi. So we're out in Corpus Christi, Texas, on the ocean or on the Gulf. It's beautiful. I don't know what color the sand is. We're going to say it's white. And we ride on the sand. Kevin loves Kathy. Okay, nice big heart. Okay, that information is understandable, right? It's based upon alphabet. It's based upon a language that you can put these codes, these symbols together, and you can read it and understand it. Okay, then we wipe it out. We just go up and we rub it all out. Okay? And we put John loves Linda. And we can wipe it out. Did the information in any of those situations have any matter to them? No. It's not like the sand's mass was increased when we wrote Kevin loves Kathy or John loves Linda. It's not like the mass of that particular area was increased at all. Nor was it decreased. Information by itself has no effect on matter. Now, you might be thinking, well, wait a minute, though. We need matter to be able to capture information. We certainly do. But the matter exists apart from the information. Okay? So, what I want to leave you with tonight is, as we roll through this information theory a bit more, we're going to cover a lot of things. We're going to talk about the fact that information arises only through will. Information does not come out of chaotic systems. It does not come about by accident. We're going to talk about how there are five levels of universal information. Universal information is rather interesting, and this is why it deals with, this is how it can refute the law or the theory of evolution, as well as atheism itself. We're going to talk about things like syntax. We're going to talk about things like statistics and how those things have to do with information theory. And I realize some of this stuff is going to be a little over your heads and it's going to stretch you a little bit. But you have to understand information theory to really grasp how the rest of this is important. Okay? So I'll close there for this evening. Any questions? Okay. So next week, I'll have some updated notes for you that'll include some of the information theory stuff. I encourage you to bring pens and papers if you want to take notes on your own. As I mentioned, I will have the notes that I'm using available for you. I'm just not going to have them until we're done with the section, because I update them pretty much every week. Okay? All right. Thanks for your time.